Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is New Books in Science Fiction, the Fungus Among Us episode. I'm Rob Wolf, author of The Alternate Universe, and today I'm pleased to have David Walton with me to talk about his new book, The Genius Plague, which made the Wall Street Journal's list of the best science fiction books of 2017. David is the author of five other books. His first, Terminal Mind, received the Philip K. Dick Award in 2008. But not only is he the award-winning author of six books, he's also an engineer for Lockheed Martin. And not only is he an engineer and author, but he's a dad of seven kids, and I'd say that qualifies as a large family in today's era of families that average 2.5 people. Hi, David. Thanks for joining me.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Given your many roles as writer, engineer, and father, each of them demanding and potentially all-consuming, how do you do it? How do you fit the pieces of the puzzle of your life together?
Well, I'll tell you, writing has always been for me a, it's something that I enjoy, something that I'm drawn to. So it's not a chore that I have to sit down to most of the time. It's something that I am always longing to have a little bit more time to do. And of course, time can be hard to come by for any of us. Certainly working a full-time job and making dinners and helping with homework and taking care of all my kids' various needs can fill up a day. But I find that writing is something that I'm always thinking about in the car, thinking about as I'm moving around my day doing different things. And so I've kind of learned to write well in the little bits of time that I have. And that's not something that I just came to in an instant. I've been writing for more than 20 years now. And I think I got to the point where it was, well, either I'm going to do this or I'm not going to do this. You know, either I'm going to find a way to make it work or it's just going to fall away. And falling away wasn't an okay answer for me. So I've, stuck with it and found a way to make it work in the little corners of time that I can pull here and there.
And can you give a picture of that? Is that in the morning commute? Is it staying up late at night? Or is it literally, you know, you've got 3-minute break between things and you can jot down a few notes?
Yeah, there is no regular pattern to it. And I've tried just about everything. I've tried the talking to my phone while I'm commuting, which I've made work sometimes. It's a little tricky, hard necessarily to concentrate that way. And then you end up with a lot of false starts and things. But I've made that work sometimes. And I'll write late in the evenings. And I used to get up early in the morning to write, but that's become a harder sell as I've gotten older. But yeah, basically, it's the corners. A lot of times it's on weekends. And grab those, those odd times when maybe I have a couple hours. That doesn't happen very often, grabbing those and making the best use of them.
I want to talk about fungi and what drew you to them as a primary subject of The Genius Plague. But before we do that, maybe it would be a good idea if you give a quick summary about the book. You know, what is the Genius Plague story?
Sure. The Genius Plague is about a fungal infection that will make you smarter if it doesn't kill you. Most people survive and it makes them smarter, but the payoff to that, or the balance to that, is that you have a fungus that is growing in your brain. And so the question is that fungus benign? Is it really serving your interests, or are you in some way serving its interests? And when you have a whole bunch of people who start to have and spread this this plague and can do some amazing things mentally and are growing in intelligence and communication ability and all of those things, is it the next stage of human evolution, or is it a plague? When some of those people start to think that it's the next stage of human evolution and really everybody should have it, it really starts to raise the question is this something that's beneficial? Are we really serving humanity, or are we really just serving the fungus?
I think it's interesting that you combined both positive attributes and negative for the fungus. I guess it doesn't really take anything away to say that the fungus is in fact the antagonist of the story. You know, it's up to something. There's a nefarious aspect to what's going on, but as you pointed out, there's also some marvelous things that it's doing. In fact, you know, it might even be on a noble mission, because one of the things that starts happening is people start having a strong desire to protect the Amazon rainforest. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about your decision to make this antagonist have these kind of noble attributes, you know, like the ability to increase someone's brain power, make them smarter, maybe make them care about the environment in a way that they might not have otherwise cared about, and yet also have this dark side.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted it to be a novel that, besides being a, you know, fast-paced adventure kind of thing, would be a novel that would make people think. And the way in which I want people to be thinking is in terms of what makes me me? What are the influences that go into the decisions that I make? And if I am influenced to do something good or do something bad, to what extent can I say, well, that was me doing that? And to what extent can I point to this other influence, whether it be other people, something that I put into my body, a sickness that I might have, or what it may be, so that we kind of wrestle with that idea. I wanted people to say, as they're reading the book, well, is this really such a bad thing? And to kind of be lulled into maybe agreeing with some of the characters or partially agreeing with some of the characters to say, well, maybe this actually would be a good thing. And what's so bad about that? And to kind of wrestle with those ideas of, is it good to make someone else be good? And you say, well, but it's good. We're causing a good thing if I force other people to be good. But at what cost? And what's the balance for that? I think there's a lot of interesting ideas to think about real life and how people interact in the human race. And wanted to explore some of those things in the context of a fun adventure novel.
I was wondering where the science of fungi ends and your imagination begins. And it might help if I read a couple sentences from the book, because I don't know if the average person appreciates how complex fungi can be. There's a doctor in the book who is studying them or treats people with fungal infections, a doctor named Mai Lin, and she talks about some of the attributes that make the fungus a fungus unique. So let me just read a little bit, and then maybe you could talk about what's factual and where your imagination came in. So she says, "Did you know fungi outnumber plants 6-1? They can survive anywhere. You can kill 99% of one, and it'll still survive. They don't even need light. Fungi have been found thriving in highly radioactive places, like reactor cooling tanks, the ruins of Chernobyl, and the rubber window seals of the International Space Station." And she ends that thought by saying, "When we finally find life on other planets, there's a good chance it'll be a fungus."
everything that she says in that passage is true about fungi, and a lot of the other things that people say throughout the book about fungi in general are in fact true. For me, books will often start with the research, where there is some scientific phenomenon or topic that catches my interest and draws me in, and I want to learn a lot about it because it's amazing. And then I draw from that and say, well, in what way would this or could this affect people in an interesting way that, that could cause a story to come out of it? And so, yeah, fungi are little known. People don't think about fungi very often, except if it's the, you know, mold on their shower or athlete's foot or what have you. But there is a remarkable diversity in the kingdom fungi. Some remarkable properties. You have fungi that are able to infiltrate other animals, and if you've seen the zombie ants portion of the BBC's Planet Earth, some amazing things there where fungi can actually cause ants to change their behavior, to choose to climb up sticks or pieces of grass and latch on so that the fungus can grow out of their brains and then erupt to send spores everywhere to infect other ants, etc. So it has a strategy of survival that involves taking control of an animal. Fungi, I mean, you have them all over you. All over your skin, you have microscopic fungi, and all over your house, there's fungi that are, you know, part of the ecosystem that we live in. And they have, you know, all kinds of, you know, very real diseases that are fungal based. So a lot of what happens in the story are things that I've drawn together from things that fungi really can do. You know, put them together into a way that that serves, you know, my ends of this, you know, kind of creepy scenario in the story.
I think one of the things that's unexpected is that we think of fungi as a lower life form. As you say, you know, the scum on the wall in the bathroom, or the annoying athlete's foot, or the mushrooms that, you know, pop up here and there might be poisonous, but not as something that might be able to plan or plot. And that's sort of an open question in your book, I think, about how cognizant and coordinated the fungus is. But in the end, the ends are quite far-reaching and certainly give the appearance of there being a strategy. And I think that's interesting. That adds to, I think, the surprise value of the story, because you don't expect that from something that we've come to think of as so-called lower life form.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of lower life forms, or what you would think of as lower life forms, that exhibit some pretty sophisticated behavior, not because they're doing it consciously, you know, the way we would with a conscious planning. But the way that they have evolutionarily developed to fit into their various niches can sometimes involve some pretty complex decision-making behavior. And in fact, we see that in fungi. We see fungi that stretches underground throughout forests, infiltrating plants and covering acres underground sometimes. And they're making all kinds of complex decisions in this, you know, brain-like network underground about where nutrients go, where moisture goes, what plants are going to thrive or die based on what is going to best benefit the fungus in its spread and in its life. Not because it's thinking about it, but because it has evolved that very complex behavior to accomplish those ends and make those, you know, respond to its environment in complex ways.
Yeah, I thought that was amazing. Is that's actually true, that a fungus can have a network, an individual entity, it can have a network that spans acres and does so much?
That is actually true. The largest organisms in the world are not blue whales or redwood trees, but individual fungi organisms. with, just miles upon miles of microscopic mycelia all curled up and going under the soil when you're walking through the forest. There are, you know, particular places where they've mapped how far they go, and acres.
So Mylin could have said that if there's another extinction event like there was with the dinosaurs, or that people say might happen with global warming, we can assume that some form of fungi will probably survive.
Yes, I think you can definitely say that.
How does your training as an engineer inform your writing? And your book touches on a number of government agencies like the NSA. I wondered how much of that was from personal knowledge. There's code breaking in the book. I don't know if that does overlap in any way with your work. And I don't know if it's classified in some way. Maybe you can't say anything. But I was curious because I thought it was an interesting, I wondered, there was potentially an interesting way to complement, you know, your work by day and then your work when you're doing your fiction writing.
Yeah, well, I think they absolutely do complement each other. I think probably the greatest advantage that my job has for my writing is that I work with a whole bunch of nerds who really enjoy science and technology and science fiction. And so I can interact with them about some of the ideas that I have, bounce things off of them. It's a great environment for the idea for a book to start to grow. Some of my friends at work, my coworkers, are among my early readers who will read the stories and comment on them and have ideas that they can throw in there. So I'd say that's probably the biggest thing. As far as the intelligence agency things that are in the book, I think what I was particularly trying to do there was to make that a realistic look at an intelligence agency, not based on any particular personal experience per se, but just on the knowledge that, you know, intelligence agencies are not, James Bond kind of situations. They're large bureaucratic organizations that have a lot of smart people working for them because they hire smart people. And have a lot of people who are varied very much in their skill set, in their personality, in their age and gender, and so it has all of the things that you would expect of a large organization, in that it has things that are slow and old in terms of processes that are entrenched and take forever to change, or, you know, complicated ways in which money flows and authority flows and all those kinds of things. In many ways, it's like a large defense contractor like Lockheed Martin that I work for. So I kind of drew from a lot of those experiences at work, what people are like, what the work environment is like, what sorts of barriers you have to accomplishing things in your job, and projected that onto my envisioning of what it would be like to work for the NSA. And I think the result is something that feels a lot more realistic than a lot of your Hollywood portrayals of, you know, sending assassins out to murder people and those sorts of things.
And I wanted to talk about another aspect of your world, and you talk about it on your website. You make no secret that you're a Christian, and you write, I'm just going to quote from your website, "Many people have wondered how I can reconcile my faith with the love of science, and particularly the theory of evolution that is evident in my books." And then you also wrote in a blog post, "I believe the Bible to be the inerrant word of God, and I think science is a wonderful and reliable source of knowledge. To many, this may seem to be contradictory," end quote. So I'm sure this is a topic that, you know, deserves a book or volumes of books, but I was hoping maybe you could share with me some of your thoughts on the compatibility of your religious beliefs with science and the science of evolution, which, in fact, plays a role in the genius plague, because you pretty much spell out that the fungus is playing by evolutionary rules when it is manipulating humans to help it survive.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. It's a favorite subject of mine, and I'll try not to go into too much depth. I would point anyone who is interested in more of my thoughts on this subject to my blog, where I have a series of blog articles going into some of the details. But yeah, I grew up with the being taught that evolution was false and was in fact silly, being taught that that was a necessary part of belief in God and acceptance of the Bible. And as I grew older, had some different experiences, particularly read Origin of the Species and a number of other science books. I love reading science books. I came face to face with the tremendous amount of evidence that there is in support of evolution, and had to figure that out. Had to figure out, well, what does that mean for my faith? And there's a lot of things that I could say about reconciling the Bible and science, but I guess I could probably sum it up by saying that it says a lot more about God and his creativity to suggest that he was able to create the diversity and wonder that we see around us through a process like evolution than it does to say that he just made it all exactly as it is without following that process. It's the difference that, as if I just built something, or if I built a robot to build something, the second one requires more creativity, more ingenuity, and it is a more amazing and impressive feat. And I would encourage anyone who is listening, who is a Christian and is serious about their faith, to not be afraid to look into the details and the specifics of science and what it says about the world around us. Because if you are holding on to a faith that requires you to have a blind eye to something and not look at it, then that's not much of a faith. You want a faith that is based on truth and based on considering all of the input that you can have. Go ahead and take a look at and understand what science has to say and the venue in which it can have quite a lot to say about our world that is true and help us to understand truth, and recognize that there are things that science can't speak to and can't answer because they get into the metaphysical, they get into the reasons of why we are here, why things happen, what is the purpose of our lives, the difference of conscious man and morality and all those kinds of considerations that science is not equipped to answer, and recognize that we can get truth from both of those places that that are in fact true together.
Did the understanding that you came to have about evolution, the change in your thinking, cause conflicts in your life with people you loved, with family or other people who held more traditionally, I suppose, anti-evolutionary beliefs?
To some extent, not as much as I'm sure some people have encountered in similar circumstances. I was an adult and married at the time when I came to the point of making that switch. And I think if my wife had been very opposed to that, that would have, she also grew up in a Christian home where, evolution was taught to be false. I think that would have been a much more difficult contentious situation if we were at odds on that. But she, even though she's not as interested in science in general as I am, came along the same path with me as I discussed the things that I was reading with her. And pretty much came to the same place that I am at about the same time that I did, though with much less of a, I guess, for me, it was very much of a passion to know all of the details that I could understand about the science, both because I liked the science and because it was such a critical thing for me in understanding what I believed and who I was. But certainly there's a conflict with our parents to some extent on that subject, but it's not something that has a ongoing contentiousness there. It's something that we know that we disagree on.
There was nothing overt in the story that would have made me think there was anything. It was not infused with a sense of any kind of religious perspective at all. But as we've been talking and the way you described what the fungus does to... Oh, and look, I don't know if you can hear the church bells in the background, but appropriately they are ringing in the background out the window on the half hour. But you were talking about the fungus, raising questions. It sounded almost like free will. Are you being guided by this thing? Is this thing... Are you making the decisions? Are we ever making the decisions? Like, I could imagine going down a path where you could actually explore some of these fundamental issues of ethics and morality that religion also explores and tries to answer, but through your writing. And I wondered if you do attempt to do that sometimes, and if in fact you maybe were with the genius plague in some parts of it.
Yeah, I'd say all my books to some extent touch on those issues, because those issues are fascinating to me. In Superposition and Supersymmetry, which are quantum physics murder mysteries, I touch on that idea of free will a fair amount, and is it our genes that control us? To what extent do we have the freedom to choose? To what extent does the predictability of the world, even down to the probability of quantum events, mean that our lives are in fact mapped out for us versus being able to make those choices ourselves? Probably the book of mine that most gets into those sorts of issues is Quintessence, which came out from Tor in 2012, and that is it's more of a fantasy leaning. I think of it as science fiction, but it has a fantasy vibe to it. It takes place in the 16th century. There are sea monsters, and they're going off to the edge of the flat Earth to discover the magic that's out there. But the magic is in fact a science. It's just a different science than was discovered by the early experimentalists in our own world. And so you don't know ahead of time what they're going to figure out. But the main character in that book is wrestling with his faith. He is a scientist before there were scientists, who is experimentalist, is doing these experiments that reveal truth about the world that conflicts with what he believes to be true on the basis of his faith. And so he is wrestling with that throughout the whole book. In all my books, though, I'm not trying to give answers to the readers, because I think fiction that tries to preach answers to the readers generally fails. There are a few exceptions, but generally a reader will bristle at me trying to write an essay in a story. They want a story. But what a story does really well is ask questions, is get you thinking, is raise these issues that maybe you don't spend a whole lot of time in your life thinking about, but they get your mind going. You think, huh, I wonder how that works, and how is that, and why do I, and this and that. And that's what I really enjoy in reading fiction, and what I enjoy trying to do in the fiction that I write.
Once one starts asking questions about faith or tenets of faith, how do you know when to stop, or do you never stop? And is it okay to always be asking questions and maybe challenging? Because once you say one thing is not necessarily true, that science contradicts or offers a different view of it, and the evidence is contrary to what, I've been taught, you could do that about many things, I imagine, in, all religions, and all religions have things like that teach something for whatever reason, for historical, because that was the state of knowledge in the past, or again, that's a whole nother treatise. But I just wonder, once you start, don't you keep asking questions over and over again?
You do. And I think I would expand that beyond just religion and say that that applies also to science and also to all of life, where I think it is a good thing to be asking questions. On the other hand, if you hold everything to be up in the air, how can you live, right? So I think what we're left with as humans is to strive for a reasoned belief, strive for an openness to questions that you never thought of before, an openness to suggestions that maybe you've been thinking about something wrong, or there's aspects of something that you haven't thought of. But at the same time, trying to use the intellect and ability that God has given you, as well as the insights and wisdom of other people, to say, what can I believe that is well-supported? What can I believe that is rational and holds true, a model of the world and life and spirituality and God that seems to hold together? Is it reasonable to believe that the Bible is true? Can I see a consistency throughout the pages of what was written by different people at different times that tells a consistent story that provides a thorough and well-motivated justification or explanation for what I see about how people act, what I see about what the world is like, what I see in my own heart and thinking, and I believe that it does. And so for me, that's a well-reasoned, well-motivated belief. I can say that, this holds true with my experiences and my thoughts and the things that I've encountered. But if I wasn't willing to question it, if I wasn't willing to consider alternate viewpoints and things that people might bring up that may question all or even just some or a tiny part of what I believe, then it's dogma. Then it becomes something that I'm holding to, not because I think it's true, but because I'm afraid of the implications of what it might mean to change my mind. And I think a tremendous amount of evil has come in the world when people hold to dogma, when people think, I'm holding on to this thing as the truth because that aligns me with a set of people and disaligns me with another set of people. And it's my identity. And so I'm going to love these people and hate these people and believe this against any evidence to the contrary without thought, because that is the least scary thing for me to do, because it's scary to consider alternate views. But I think it's necessary and important both for our own growth and the realism of our beliefs, and also for the ability to understand and care for others and say, I understand why you think the way you do, even though it's different than the way I do, and so we can get along.
What's next on the horizon for you? What's next for you book-wise?
I have a finished manuscript, which I hope you will be seeing. Which you will certainly be seeing sometime in the future. I don't have a release date for it yet, but it's called Three Laws Lethal, and it is an artificial intelligence story based on, my computer science background and engineering background and knowledge of what AI is doing today and how that field is progressing, in combination with the rising self-driving car movement, and saying, let's explore the idea of a truly conscious artificial intelligence that would grow out of that movement, where we are trying to put life and death decisions about humans in the hands of cars. And it's not simply a robots rise and kill all the humans kind of story, because that's been done before. And to me, that's a little bit boring. This is a much more like The Genius Plague, a reasoned and two-sided look at how, you know, what's the meaning of consciousness, and what does it mean to be conscious, and how can you recognize it when it's there, and what kinds of ethical considerations does that bring about having a machine consciousness, and how might we interact with it, and what does it mean to have, you know, our changing world where we're putting such decisions in the hands of computers, and you know, all of those kinds of considerations. I think it's an exciting and fun novel. I'm looking forward to the chance for a lot of people to read it and tell me what they think.
I can't wait to see it, because the idea of those self-driving cars kind of scares me. I mean, logically, of course, it sounds like a computer managing speed and distance and being alert with radar to all around you would keep you safer, but somehow it creeps me out. So I think it's a good place to start with a book. In fact, it's a great idea, I think. So I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Great.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate your being on New Books in Science Fiction.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with David Walton about his new book, The Genius Plague, which came out in October. If you want to hear more author interviews, visit the Science Fiction channel of newbooksnetwork.com or subscribe to our podcast. Our theme music is by Michael Aaron. The editor-in-chief of the New Books Network is Marshall Poe. And the editor is Leanne Wilson. I'm Rob Wolf, author of The Alternate Universe, and I'm grateful you took the time to listen. Thanks, and I hope you have a wonderful 2018.